in any of our spiritual expression, and that's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And in Buddhism, that means certain things. But you're taking it more into that feminine place, and I'd love for you to describe what that means in a feminine perspective.
I think that's what I'm doing with throughout the book, by the way, is I'm looking at these classic wisdom teachings that are also classically masculine through a feminine lens. And like, why not? You know, it's the sky has not fallen yet as I've dared to question and reframe these established wisdom teachings. So that's one of my favorites. So I'm so glad you brought it up. The triple gem, or the three jewels, which is taking refuge in Buddhism. It's the refuge vow. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. It's a very serious vow. But what if we look at it through the lens of the feminine, not so much as I promise to do this with my, you know, grim determination, but rather I take refuge, which is what the vow says. So I take refuge in the Buddha. What does that mean through the lens of the feminine? It means looking to all of these exemplars. Like you spoke about the contemporary women that I speak of in the book. To me, they're exemplars of the way, of the beauty way, of the wisdom way, of the way of awakening and service that I hope is the path that we're all on here. And so look to those women exemplars across the spiritual traditions, living and no longer living, embodied or archetypes and goddess beings. Who are the exemplars of the path that we're walking? So that's taking refuge in the Buddha in the form of all these women. What is it to take refuge in the Dharma through the lens of the feminine? That is to look for, and it's not always easy to find, the wisdom teachings of the feminine across, again, across the spiritual traditions. They're buried very intentionally, but they are there. How do we excavate those wisdom teachings and look to the teachings of the feminine? Whether it's the wisdom of Shabbat in the Jewish tradition as the day of rest, of holy rest and renewal. And that Shabbat itself in the Jewish wisdom teachings is feminine. She is the Shekhinah, the indwelling feminine presence who comes and fills our souls on Shabbat and lives in exile the rest of the time. And my interest there, again, is questioning everything. Like, why does the Shekhinah have to live in exile? Why can't we reclaim her so that she is with us, embodied in our human experience all the time? So taking refuge in the Dharma means to look at these wisdom teachings through the lens of the feminine, excavate them, bring them out, share them. To take refuge in the Sangha, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh said famously, the next Buddha will be the Sangha. You know, so many religions have this sort of second coming notion that we're waiting for the Messiah, we're waiting for Maitreya Buddha, we're waiting for these beings to come along and rescue us. And so what about, we are the ones we've been waiting for, as the Hopi prophecy says. So to take refuge in the Sangha is to take refuge, to rest in the interbeing that we belong to, in the community of each other. And to me, that's the essence of the feminine. Is she builds community. She recognizes everybody as an essential nexus in that web of interbeing. The whole hierarchical model of a guru dispensing his spiritual goodies to the poor, hungry slobs below is over. The way of the feminine is that we all have a cup of elixir to bring to the table of human awakening and service, because to me those two things are intertwined.
Well, I can think of a wonderful example of what you're talking about. In the 2017 inauguration of the outcome of the 2016 election in the U.S., the day after that, I mean, we all were thinking, okay, if we, here in the U.S., if there's a woman president in the White House, all is safe. The feminine is safe, and it's all going to happen. And then that didn't happen. But what did happen was hundreds of thousands of millions of women and men and householders and babies and got out in the street and expressed together that longing to be another way. We're all taking responsibility, in other words, for manifesting the feminine and the togetherness. It was so wonderful. I was in Oakland at the march, and there were thousands of people, and there was not one incident of anything that was untoward or that was violent in any way. Everyone was so kind and filled with goodness and love and song and celebration together. I just get chills thinking about it. And that was a blessing. So could you see that it wasn't like depending on the one avatar, the one woman that would take us someplace, but that we're all doing it together?
That's a perfect example, Justine, of this phenomenon. I think I say in the very introduction to this book something about the feminine is the earth is breaking open and the feminine is spilling out. I say it right here. The secret is out. The celebration is overflowing its banks. The joy is becoming too great to contain. The pain has grown too urgent to ignore. The earth is cracking open, and the women are rising from our hiding places and spilling onto the streets, lifting the suffering into our arms, demanding justice from the tyrants, pushing on the patriarchy and activating a paradigm shift such as the world has never seen. And we're doing it through love. You're absolutely right. And everywhere I go with this book, which has just come out, what I'm finding is that it's not about Mirabai Starr has a new book out proclaiming that, you know, the feminine mystics are the answer to fixing the problems of the world. It's about community. Everywhere I go, I recognize that this book is just an expression of a discourse that is happening everywhere. And so there's the sense of ownership around Wild Mercy that has been incredibly invigorating for me. It's about us. And this is one of the circles where women are coming together and remembering that only together can we rise to the call to mend the broken world.
And that reminds me, you talk about activism in the book, the erroneous way we have done it in the past. And maybe still a little bit now, and we need to guard against, is like setting up the perpetrator and the victim.
Yeah.
And you use a word, otherizing, making the other wrong, and, oh, they did it wrong, and we're going to blame them, and then we take that on, oh, we're the victim. And it just, you're saying that we need to do it a different way.
Yeah.
The feminine, it's different from that.
That's right.
And this is not the easy, because we want to blame someone for polluting the river and doing this and that, but there's another way to work with it.
Right, and I think it's definitely the natural way of the feminine, and I use that word guardedly and remind listeners that when I talk about the natural way of the feminine, I'm talking about the feminine in all of us, people of all genders, is to connect and relate first. That the feminine, rather than analytically decide and determine what's broken and what needs to be fixed and how, that mechanistic view is very masculine. The feminine actually first allows her heart to open to the pain of the world, to the broken climate and to the suffering of the human family and the animal family and Mother Earth herself. And then by actually allowing ourselves to feel the pain of the world in the cells of our own body, which is a very feminine response, our container is often shattered through that painful encounter with reality. And then that shattered container becomes more boundless. It ends up with a boundless capacity to then hold the pain of the world and to also hold the ambiguity of the world. That it's not all this or that. I mean, I personally encounter this, as many of you do. I have a child who's 40, just turned 40, and she has taken a very different social path than I have and political path. And she lives in a very small town in America, married to a guy who's like an NRA advocate. That is kind of the opposite of my political values. And yet when I go and visit them, the love is so strong that it brings me to tears, and them too. The love between us, the love they have for their family and their little small community, and our political values just dissolve. It's just about the human connection between us. And I believe that every time I show up and don't act like a self-righteous liberal, but act like a mom and grandma and just love these people up, peace on earth is unfolding in our midst. And it's not enough, but it counts.
Well, that reminds me of a story you tell of Christine, who's this PhD, very learned person, and she's teaching in a Christian school, and she has these bratty boys that are just giving her a bad, bad time. And she could just really slam them if she wanted to. But she took a different path. Do you recall that path that
yes.
she took and how she turned that around?
Yes, it's Christina Cleveland, by the way. Check her out. She is a theologian, a young African-American theologian who is doing really radical, wonderful work. But this was early in her teaching career. And so she was a black woman in a fundamentalist Christian white school. And these young men were totally giving her a hard time, just challenging everything she said. And it was very irritating, I'm sure. But what she decided to do, she had just learned about the term namaste. I honor the light within you. And even though she was a Christian, she took this beautiful Hindu phrase, this Sanskrit phrase, namaste, I honor the light within you. And she kind of turned it inside her own soul to a more Judeo-Christian friendly version of I see the light of God in me sees the light of God in you, or something like that. And she decided that every time those guys would do their thing in the classroom, she would pause and silently send them love, the love of God in me. Bows to the love of God. And I can't remember how it is, but it's in the book.
Yeah.
Something like that. And just the pause, the converting it into love in her heart, when you're right, absolutely intellectually, she could have totally just excoriated them. But she didn't. She brought it down into the heart, sent them love, and little by little, over the course of the semester, it completely disarmed them, so that by the end of the semester, they were her buddies, they were her advocates, and they had huge openings in their own sociopolitical awareness.
I'm here with Mirabai Starr. She is the author of Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Here with Mirabai Starr, and she is the author of Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics. And Mirabai, I'd love for you to give a flavor of your writing and on a certain subject that you call householder yoga. And if you could just do a little bit of a reading from householder yoga for our listeners.
Sure. See if any of you relate to this. I suspect you might. Give me a cave in the Himalayas with no heat aside from a smoky fire pit, only the food brought to me by those willing to hike up the mountains, and nothing to do all day but meditate and chant and read the sacred scriptures. Such a sadhana, or spiritual practice, has got to be easier than raising a child, living with her other parent, and trying to make a harmonious home. What person on a spiritual path who also has a family has not had this thought? Welcome to Householder Yoga. If yoga means path to union with God, then hooking up with a life partner and having kids together can be as valid and certainly as rigorous as living in an ashram, engaged in spiritual discipline all day and into the night, and as transformational. Every culture and religious tradition controlled by men has placed higher importance on scriptural study and ritual observance than on feeding babies and cleaning up after them. Women have internalized our own devaluation. No wonder many women with the privilege of making the choice are choosing not to have children. Child rearing is arguably the most difficult path possible, a hero's journey that leads us on harrowing adventures, but for which we receive almost no credit. So, given that being a parent is such a challenging and unglamorous enterprise, why bother? Because sentient beings are made to. Most of us are anyway. We're biologically, socially, and spiritually programmed to connect with one another and create new humans. And we are perfectly designed to care for them. The mistakes we make are part of the package. Our fears for their well-being are impossible to circumvent. We are bound to stumble through the experience of being someone's mom, just as our mothers fumbled through their own motherly missions, maybe with more awareness than they did, but not with any more certainty.
So that was so well said, and any comment that you might have on that, because throughout the book, it always comes back to that. What about the embodiment, the practicality of our spiritual practice? It's not just, as you say, on the mountaintop or in a cave, but it's in the marketplace, it's in the family, it's doing the dishes.
Yeah. So this book is not about different goddesses or different spiritual traditions chapter by chapter. This book, every chapter, deals with some aspect of everyday life, you know, like mothering, like sexuality, creativity, stewardship of the earth, forgiveness and reconciliation, death and dying, all of the things that as human beings, especially feminine human beings, we not only deal with, but in which we find the presence of the sacred. So for me, the primary practice is about learning to be present with things as they are. And there are spiritual technologies available to us across the spiritual traditions that help us to cultivate that depth and degree of mindful, heartful presence in everything we do. So sometimes we need to actually sit on the cushion or engage in sacred chanting or other spiritual methodologies that raise the consciousness and open the heart, not in order to get up and out of this world, but precisely so that then we can take that loving awareness, as Ram Dass says, into the heart of the world and infuse everything that we do with that spirit of love and devotion and holy presence. So that's where the line between action and contemplation dissolves and between personal spiritual experience and tikkun olam, to use the Hebrew term of repairing the world, that prophetic urge to be present to the web of interbeing and participate with all our hearts in mending it.
You have studied and become a bereavement counselor. And you have gone through just your own tremendous bereavement with your daughter Jenny, with your brother died when you were very young and he was young, and you've experienced a lot of death and dying directly in your life. And you tell a story about the two Kates, and these are two women that also have lost daughters. And what I love about the story that you tell and the advice that you give, and this is a warning to all of us that we think we can help someone else because we've gone through this same thing. What is your advice about how we should be with another as they are going through grief or bereavement?
Yes, it's such a wonderful and important question. So that section of the book, it's my favorite title of the whole book, of a section, and I call it, I Will Be Demeter and You Be Persephone. It's like we make these soul agreements that we never would have made with our rational minds to enter into these harrowing experiences, like the loss of a child. And in that section, I speak about two women that I know and love named Kate, both of whom lost their daughters in tragic accidents, one through murder, the other was run over by a car while riding her bicycle. And I thought, and they thought, okay, I've been through this. Mirabai's been through this, and she can be a resource to me. I can be a resource to them. I already had studied grief counseling and had a certificate. But there is a way in which the only thing we can do in the presence of unbearable anguish is hold loving witness, a space of loving witness for that person, and not think we know. And to me, Justine, that is the feminine way, is the way of unknowing. Not of figuring it out and telling everybody else the way it is, but about being with things as they are, opening to those liminal spaces that are deeply feminine spaces, being willing to abide in ambiguity and live the mystery in community. And that's what we can do with people when they're grieving. And most of us have been through tremendous losses, you know, unbearable losses that we've managed to bear. Some maybe not as dramatic as losing a child like mine, but many of you listening are part of that club, and you know how it is impossible, and yet somehow we do. But what we wanted, what we longed for when these losses happened to us, was someone who wasn't afraid of the fire of our pain and could sit beside that blaze with us, sit in the fire with us without imposing their own ideas about it, and certainly not telling us about the time their dog died, you know, and how they understand.
I think that that's such an important point. It's not easy to do, because when we see someone else in grief, we want to go just rush in and embrace them and change their bereavement. But what you're saying, the stronger thing to do, the more rooted thing to do, is to take a deep breath and to trust their bereavement.
Yes, beautifully said, Justine. And yes, we want to rush in and fix them or help them or change them, but we also want to run away. That's also a really common response, and it's more of a masculine response, like get me away from these messy human experiences and feelings. But the true feminine response is just as you say, to take a breath and enter and just hold a space of loving witness, to be with them. That's what we crave when we're shattered.
I think that maybe women know this a bit more easily than men. It's a little easier for us to embody, I'm going to say this, because of two things. Either childbirth that we've gone through, and if we haven't gone through that as women, we've gone through menstruation every month.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of letting go. That's just giving in. There's nothing we can do about it. We just give in to it. And that helps. I think that helps us to sort of be there in whatever is happening for however long it's happening.
Yes, and the men I know who are really good at this, and I do know some, famous and not so famous, have that feminine heart that also is willing to just be in the unknowingness and the uncontrollability of death and grief.
And that's what we're being asked and called upon, even now at this time of great death and grief on a worldwide scale.
Yes.
So to be there and to hold it, as you say, the paradox, and this is not easier. And so you give us lots of advice of how to sit on the cushion, do the practice, but then bring it into the daily life. And if there's anything else that you want to add to that?
I think that there is a death going on globally. Who knows what's going to happen with the environment? And also with the social structures, the existing kind of masculine paradigm, social structures, there is a crumbling, there is a disintegrating of what we have come to depend on. And maybe our task, as Andrew Harvey actually so beautifully says, is to be the midwives of this death and the inevitable resurrection or rebirth that will come from it.
Mirabai, I want to thank you so much for being part of New Dimensions today.
Thank you. It is such a joy to have this deep history with you and with the spirit of Michael Toms, who is with us.
Oh, thank you. That feels so delicious. I've been speaking with Mirabai Starr. She's the author of Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, Mirabai Starr, M-I-R-A-B-A-I. Star, S-T-A-R-R, MirabaiStar.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3672.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. This program was recorded at Strawberry Hill Productions, a full-service podcast production studio in Novato, California. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Letting it burn. This is knowing there's nothing to do but you. you're tuned in to